This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com.
Good morning. It is Sunday, December 2nd. We'll see if we maybe even be able to finish off this class on stringencies. I know for the uploads, I haven't put them up because they're all based on one source sheet, so I figure we'll just do one mega podcast at the end. So we just took care of Lifnei Mishurat HaDin, and we're now into what I have here, Section 6, dealing with special individuals.
Page 8,
on the current... I say current because, you know, mildly annoying things about learning more is I keep going back and editing source sheets. So, you know, this is what it is, at least on this associated source sheets. There's nothing to proclaim. It's like, hey, you know, this marker would go really great here. I should really go back and do it. So, anyway, that's why I try repeating on, you know, the recording here. I almost instinctively still say tape, even though no one has tapes anymore. Yeah. You know, the 99 cents store, they still sell tapes? I find it so hilarious. Anyway, but that's the reason why I try to announce, you know, what the sources that we're discussing, because that much doesn't change. Well, sometimes it does, especially when dealing with the numbering of Mishnayot. Anyway, George, start us off. This is Mishnah Ta'anit 1-4. We saw a little bit about this earlier.
If the 17th of...
Mar Cheshvan.
Right, so there's a funny the month of Cheshvan, which really ought to be pronounced Marach Shavan.
Or Marach Shavan originally.
Marach Shavan, yes. Marach Shavan. Right, now the problem is, you know, it then became to Mar Cheshvan because, you know, people don't go back and find the sources for things, and then came to two words, Mar Cheshvan, the bitter month of Cheshvan. But yeah, so in the Gemara here, it's one word. Yeah.
And no rain fell, the Yehidim individuals begin to fast three fasts. They may eat and drink after it gets dark, and on these fasts, it is permissible for them to do work, to bathe, to anoint themselves with oil, to wear shoes, and to have marital relations.
All right. So you've got here Yehidim. You've got something that certain individuals can do. Take the next Mishnah, George Still. Mishnah Tanit 1-5. Continue.
If these fast days pass and there was no answer to their prayers, the Beis Din ordain upon the community three further fasts. On the days preceding these fasts, they may eat and drink only whilst it is still day. And they may not, on these fast days, do work, or bathe, nor anoint themselves with oil, nor wear shoes, nor have marital relations.
So we've got two different things here about stringencies that are appointed on communities. Whereas in the first Mishnah, you're talking about yichidim, right, individuals. According to the next Mishnah, if there's still, you know, nothing happening, then a Beit Din can ordain, right? Beit Din Gozerin, they actually set up a decree, Shalosh Ta'aniot Al Hatzibor, on the community, right?
When it says Yehidim, individuals, are they talking about individuals in the community, or this guy or that guy?
That is a wonderful question. Yeah? Take us to the Gemara. this is Gemara Ta'anit 10a and B.
Who are the Yechidim?
There's your question. It's a wonderful question. Fantastic.
Peak.
Yeah.
Rav Huna said, the rabbis of Tzfat.
Meaning the rabbis. So that's one, right? So who are these rabbis? I'm Rav Huna, Rabbanan, right? Our teachers. So these individuals are the religious elite take these on themselves, right?
The rabbis have taught, let not a man say, I am but a disciple and I am therefore not worthy to consider myself a Yechid, since all disciples of the wise are accounted yechidim. Who is a yechid, and who is a disciple?
Right, so stop here for a second. Kol tamidei chachamim yechidim. So according to this other source here, is that every student can be considered a yechid, meaning it's not just the Rabbanan, right, but the tamidei chachamim, not just elite, but even a student can sort of promote himself to this level of yechid. And we saw a source like that earlier in the source sheets here. Continue.
A yachid is one worthy to be appointed leader of a community. A disciple is one who is asked any question of halacha connected with his studies and can answer it. even though it is on a subject dealt with in the tractate Kala.
Meaning something that isn't that well studied. So if you think it's like, oh, anyone studying in yeshiva counts? No, you actually need to know what you're talking about. Mm. Yeah.
Our rabbis have taught, not everyone desirous to consider himself a yachid may do so. A disciple, however, may do so. This is the opinion of Rab Meir. Rab Yossi says, anyone may do so, and may he be remembered for good, because it is not an advantage to him, but a hardship.
All right, so here we actually have a dispute, because we're talking, you know, in terms of stringencies. Here's a case where people taking on sort of additional fasting. So there's a dispute here now between Rav Meir and Rav Yossi. The Meir says, not everyone can do so. You need to be of a certain stature. Rav Yossi says, sure, anyone can, because it's hard. Meaning, you know, it's one thing to say, I'm going to take on an extra role. Like, I'm going to promote myself because I get titled. Here, it's not a good thing you're doing yourself. It's something bad. So if you want to take on bad stuff for yourself, go right ahead. Right? You know, there are no real perks to this. Like, you're not, you know, this is a pretty big deal.
Look who thinks he's nothing.
Exactly. Well, it's more than that. It's like, you know, it's, you know, there's a certain degree of masochism involved here. You know, it's like, you know, like, you know, hey, look, this guy wants to make his life harder. We ain't going to stop him. All right, continue.
Another Braitha teaches, not everyone desirous to consider himself a yachid may do so. A disciple, however, may do so. This is the opinion of Rav Shimon, son of Rabbi Eliezer. Rav Shimon ben Gamliel says, this only applies to things which are to his distinction, but in things which cause him hardship, anyone may do so, and may he be remembered for good, because it is not an advantage to him, but a hardship.
Now, keep in mind the paradox here, right? The problem is, a davar shel shevach, you're not supposed to. But here, it's a davar tzar, it's something that's painful, v'zachur latov, he should be remembered for good, but being remembered for good, isn't that a type of shevach? Isn't that a type of praise? That's where you get to look who think he's nothing.
Yeah.
There's a bit of a, you know, logical quandary there. Because if you're saying we should remember someone for good, I mean, you see the point. The other difficulty here is that it seems that because it's a tsar, because it is difficulty, because it causes him pain, that's the reason why it's permitted.
Okay, it's not showing off it because it's...
Right, and we'll hold off on that whole question of Zachor Latov not being shevach.
Why do they believe that fasting will relieve the drought?
Separate question. I would have to go through a whole bunch of Masechet Tanit, which we will at some point in Daf Yomi. Let's go to the next section here. I'm taking on extra vows, right? Because this is a type of stringency as well, where, you know, you're doing more than what is commanded, and you're doing so very definitively. This is Gemara at the very beginning of Chulin 2a.
Is it not written, and if thou shalt forbear to vow, it shall be no sin to in thee. And it is further written, better it is that thou shouldest not vow, than thou shouldest vow and not pay.
Right, so you've got two psukim here. One is you shouldn't delay repaying a neder, lo techdal lindor, right, because you don't want to have sin for not paying back the vow. That we're also told in Kohelet, tova shelo tidor, misha tidor vid lo tishalem. Better that you not, mistranslate that if you make a vow, you shouldn't delay on paying back. We're also told, better you not take a vow than paying a vow, than taking a vow and not paying it back. So the question then is, Vatanya, right?
And it has been taught, better than both is... he who does not vow at all. This is the opinion of Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Judah says, better than both is he who vows and pays.
Right, so then the question is, what is the halachic opinion regarding taking a vow, making a pledge? So according to Rabbi Meir, is you're better off not taking a vow. Because if you don't take a vow, then you're never going to be a sin. Like, you don't have to take a vow. Like, if you want to give a korban, give a korban. Who says you have to make a neder? All right, so Rabbi Yehuda says, no, it's actually better if you take a vow and you pay it back.
Isn't that the expected course?
Right, but as opposed to not taking a vow at all. Meaning, taking a vow and not paying it back, everyone agrees is bad, right? Like, and call it, Tovashu lo tidor mishi toward tidor v'lo tishalem, you're better off not making a vow if it means you haven't paid it back yet. So does that mean you're better off not taking a vow at all, or taking a vow and paying it? Right? Which one are you better off? So Rav Meir says you're better off not doing anything. Rav Yehuda, however, says that you're better off, right, tov mizeh umizeh noder mishalem, that if you make a neder and you pay, that's actually good. However,
Now even Rav Judah refers only to the case of one who says, behold, let this be a sacrifice, but not in the case of one who says, behold, I take it upon me to bring a sacrifice.
Right, because one is a matter of an object. Nice little brisker chiluk here. One is on the chefta, the object, the cow in hand, or the person. Meaning, if I have a cow, there's a halachic distinction between whether or not I say, this cow is going to be a korban, or if I say personally, I am obligating myself to bring a korban. Right? So according to Rabbi Yehuda, you're better off, like, what is good is if you say, this cow is going to be a korban, and you sacrifice that korban. That's according to Rav Yehuda good. But if you're going, it's better off, it seems according to Rav Yehuda, not to make a neder at all than to do one on you as a person. And the Gemara goes through distinctions. For example, like if the cow happens to die, gets hit by, I don't know, a truck, a runaway wagon, if that and, you know, can't be offered as a sacrifice anymore, if you said hare zo, then you wouldn't have to bring it because it's now pasul. But if you say hare alai, that the obligation is on me, then you have to basically, you have to give it no matter how many cows, you know, you run through. All right, take the next one. This is Nedarim 77b.
For Rav Dimi, the brother of Rav Safra, learned, he who vows, even though he fulfills it, is designated a sinner.
Wow. Afal pishu mekayemo nikra chote. Yeah.
Rav Zavid said, what verse teaches this? But if thou shalt forbear to vow, it shall be no sin in thee. Hence, if thou hast not forborne, there is sin.
Yeah. And if if you didn't do anything, you wouldn't have sin. The implication is once you do, you've now like opened that possibility. So according to these two sources, taking on extra vows is really dicey. It's not something that's really looked upon favorably. Yes, you have a great deal of Torah that discusses the rules of Nedarim, especially regarding bringing stuff to the temple. That doesn't mean that this was a favorable thing to do. I mean, if you want to bring stuff, you want to do something extra, right? Do it on your own. Like, you can do it on your own without doing a certain degree of formalism, which could, not formalism, without making a very formal declaration saying, I am now accepting this burden in a very ritualistic manner. And this is more of a way of, you know, creating on you a new religious obligation as opposed to doing something more. So you may be able to say, just giving an extra korban, that's fine. Once you start doing it officially in a way, and that opens you up to violating another prohibition of not keeping a neder, that seems to be bad. This would, I think, come under the category also of kol mosif gorea, or not kol, or, you know, certainly like trying to add more, a chumer shemevi dui de kul in that sort of sense. By taking on the extra responsibility to do more, you're putting yourself at risk to come out in the negative. Right? Another interesting category here is a fascinating argument regarding the Nazir. And we'll see that there's a bit of a debate here that people like to attribute primarily to Rambam and Ramban, Maimonides and Nachmanides. Whereas Maimonides views the Nazir unfavorably, Nachmanides views the Nazir favorably. And really, it's not a machloket between Rambam and Ramban, it's a machloket in the Gemara. And it's, you know, we'll see exactly what that means. Here's the problem. According to, we have two psukim that discuss the Nazir. And what is the Nazir? Here's an individual who takes it upon himself in a very formal way to be, I don't want to say a different type of person as much as accept a certain halachic status that entails a certain restrictions of things that he's not allowed to do. The problem is we've got two verses that define the Nazir two different ways, one that seems to be more positive, one more negative. In Bamidbar, Numbers 6:5, We're told, Kol Yemei Neder Nizro, Ta'a Lo Yuval Rosho, Amalot Yamim, Asher Yazil Hashem, Kodesh Yag Gidel Para Se'ar Rosho. During the entire period of his vow of separation, no razor may be used on his head. He must be holy until the period of his separation to the Lord is over. He must let the hair of his head grow long. No, Kodesh Yag Gidel, yeah. All right, that's how, or at least whatever this translates it as. Anyway, but later on in the chapter, Numbers 6:5, here's Numbers 6:11. The priest is to offer one as a sin offering, because the other as a burnt offering, and the other as a burnt offering, to make atonement for him, because he sinned in the presence of the dead body. That is, the same day is to be consecrated his head. V'asa kohen et chatat, ha-kohen echad l'chatat v'echad l'ola v'chiper alav. That at the end of the Nazir, they're offering a chatat offering as a certain form of atonement. So on one hand, we've got one verse that seems to imply that this Nazir is kodesh, which is usually defined as a good thing, right? We're told kidoshim tiyu, we're supposed to be holy, supposed to be good. On the other hand, it seems at the end, he's criticized in that what is brought is a sin offering for atonement. Questions already? Because most of your questions are probably going to be addressed in the Gemara.
It was just a word thing.
Oh.
The Kadesha and stuff are the opposite of holy.
Yeah.
Set aside.
Sorry, that'll take us way off topic.
How does one become a Nazir? By taking both?
Yep.
Abstain?
Pretty much.
So
there's actually a whole tractate on Nazir, and in terms of like what different formulas work for another.
Okay, but if he takes the vow and he fulfills it, isn't that one of the things we just discussed before?
Well, that's exactly why it's a question here. Because in one part it's considered holy, another part, despite that, it's considered a chata. There's something that's considered a sin associated with it. So the Sifrayon here says, to make atonement, what is Elazar HaKafar said, and what nefesh, and for what nefesh did he sin for which he requires atonement? For his own nefesh, not sure why I didn't translate this, for his own soul, which he afflicted by refraining from wine. And are these not logically inferred? Just as one who afflicts himself by refraining from wine is considered a sinner, how much more so for refraining from everything? Said Rav Yishmael, said the Torah is referring to an impure Nazir. But the Torah says, atone for the sin which he sinned through impurity of the dead. So according to the Sifrei here, you've got two opinions. The opinion of Rav Elazar Kafa here is, the problem that he did was he restricted himself from the world, which is considered a sin, and then he extrapolates how much more so. In which case, a certain degree of stringency that leads to asceticism, according to Rav Elazar Kafa, is indicative of sin. Rav Yishmael has a different spin on it. He said, no, that the actual sin that he did was he came into contact with a dead person, which was in fact a sin for him. Because we're running a little bit late, let me do the Gemara in Ta'anit 11a and b. Samuel says, whoever fasts for the sake of self-affliction is termed a sinner. Right? It's a pretty big deal right there. For anyone who wants to like take on additional stuff. He is of the same opinion as the following Tana, who has been taught, Rav Elazar HaKafar Barevi says, what is Scripture referring to when it says of the Nazarite, thou shalt make atonement for him? For he sinned by reason of the soul. Against which soul did he sin? It must refer to the fact he denied himself wine. This is quoting kind of the Sifrei that we just read. It must refer to the fact that he denied himself wine. Sorry. We can now... Excuse me. We can now make inference from minor to major. If this man, a Nazirite, who denied himself wine only is termed sinner, how much more so he who denies himself the enjoyment of ever so many things? So this is pretty much the opinion of Rambam. Rebbe Elazar says he is termed holy, as it is says, he shall be holy, shall the locks of the hair of his head grow long. If this Nazirite who denied himself wine only is termed holy, how much more so he who denies himself the enjoyment of ever so many things? So this is the exact opposite. And this is effectively your machloket, your dispute between Rambam and Ramban, where you can say, you can focus on the sin part. It's like, well, if you are called a sinner and you restricted yourself wine, then certainly it would apply to everything else. But you could do it the other way too and say, well, he calls him Kodesh. So if he's supposed to be Kodesh, then maybe you become sanctified by abstaining from everything. And you become Kodesh, you become holy effectively by assuming an ascetic lifestyle. That's the debate here.
How will then Samuel explain the verse, wherein then is termed holy? So then the question is, well, each side, you know, one side focuses on holy, on the kadosh part. The other side focuses on the chatat part. Each one has to explain it on behalf of the other, right? Because the word is still there. You can't pretend that it doesn't say kodesh, and you can't pretend that it doesn't say you're bringing a chatat and he needs kapara, right? So it's going to ask, how does each one explain the other one's verse? So what does it mean, holy? That refers to the locks growing long. So according to that opinion, it's the Kodesh Yiyeh, refers specifically to the Gidel, contextually, immediately afterwards, he would read it as, Kadosh Yiyeh Gadel Peras Arosho, kind of reading it as, what is holy, or you know, sanctified, is the fact that, or the locks that are growing long, right? That's how the opinion of Shmuel is going to be read. So, how will Rav Elazar explain the statement, he has turned sinner? That is because he defiled himself by contact with the dead. All right, that was the opinion, as we saw in the Sifri, of Rabbi Yishmael. So, but did Rav Elazar say so? Is that true? Did he not say, let a man always consider himself as if the Holy One dwells within him? As it is said, the Holy One in the midst of thee, and I will not come in fury, there is no contradiction. The one speaks of him who is able to bear self-affliction, and the other one who is not able. So a huge distinction here according to Rav Elazar. It seems to be the problem isn't so much someone who takes on the stuff, but it's someone who takes on the stuff but isn't able to withstand it, right? Reish Lakish says, he who is termed pious, as it is said, the pious man weans his own soul, but he that is cruel. Sheshet said, let the young scholar would afflict himself by fasting, let a dog devour his meal. Nev Yirmiah ben Abba said, there are no public fasts in Babylonia, except for the fast of the ninth of Av. Rav Yirmiah bar Abba further said in the name of Reish Lakish, a scholar may not afflict himself by fasting because he lessens his heavenly work. Right? So a fascinating thing here in terms of certain degrees of stringencies in terms of living a life of privation. So according to, as I'm reading, you know, the whole Gemara, even according to the opinion of Rav Elazar, a Nazir might be okay only if it doesn't interfere with anything else. It's not that being a Nazir, accepting on these restrictions, are intrinsically, I mean, I'll say like, yes, they're good, but they're only good if you can handle it. If you can't handle it, then it's going to be bad, right? Following the other things, if you're going too fast, right? If you're going to be a, if you give a really important lecture and you decide to take on extra fast, but that means that you can't actually do your job, then your fasts are kind of worthless because you've got more important things to do. There's a set of priorities here. Right? That's more important for you, right? If you're doing God's work, that's more important than if you take on a fast just because you happen to feel like it. And so too, when you think about a Nazir, if you can handle it, meaning it's not that much of a tzar, not that much of an affliction for you, right, to withhold from wine. Like, I don't drink wine. If I say, I'm not going to drink wine for a while, not a big deal, right? Right, but you know, it's a matter of are you really like right? If you are afflicting yourself that badly, even Rav Elazar would say it's being a Nazir is not a good thing.
If you touch a dead body, don't you become tamei?
Right, but there are additional restrictions. Normally, it's not prohibited to become tamei unless you're in a certain situation. For example, a kohen can't. Right? Or at least not for unless for me. But yeah, so the general rule is, yeah.
So why do they attach the notion of Nazir with the dead body?
Because it's one of the things of the restrictions that comes up with laws of Nazir. Hold on a second. Yeah. All right, so let's run through the Pesukim here because I have a few questions on exactly what this Nazir thing is. It's always here if we do the, or at least a few psukim here. So, this is B'Midbar Vav, Numbers chapter 6, beginning with verse 1. God said to Moses, saying, Daber el b'nei Yisrael v'amarta alehem, Ish o isha kiafli lindor neder nazir lazir l'ashem. That if a person decides to take an oath to become a nazir before God, Neyayin v'sheichar yazir, from new or aged wine he shall abstain. He shall not drink vinegar or wine or vinegar of aged wine. Anything in which grapes have been steeped he shall not drink, and fresh and dried grapes he shall not eat. All the days of his abstinence, anything made from wine grapes, even the pipes or skin, he shall not eat. all the days of his Nazarite vow, a razor shall not pass over his head until the completion of the days that he will be a Nazarite for the sake of Hashem. Holy shall be he. The growth of his hair and his head shall grow. All the days of his abstinence for the sake of Hashem, he shall not come near a dead person. Al nefesh meit lo yavo. To his father, to his mother, to his brother, to his sister, he shall not contaminate himself to them upon their death, for the crown of God is on his head. Pretty explicit there. All right? Okay. Let's move along. Last page so we can finish off the class here. Another case here is, you know, when people accept stringencies, there are a lot of reasons why people do so. And they're usually not, you know, for good reasons. I was talking to Dr. Barron about this once, about people who accept on certain stringencies as a form of overcompensating, or people who might do things for the wrong reason. George, can you take the Gemara in Sanhedrin 25a?
A certain slaughterer was found to have passed a treif.
A treifa.
As fit for food.
Meaning, I'm a shochet, and I say, hey, this is kosher, and it really wasn't kosher. Shocking.
And you knew.
Yeah, he's passing. Yeah, he's passing this stuff off.
Isn't that up in New City?
Yeah.
So Rabbi Nachman disqualified and dismissed him. Thereupon, he went and let his hair and nails grow. Then Rabbi Nachman thought of reinstating him, but Rabbi said to him, "Perhaps he is only pretending repentance. What then is his remedy?" The course suggested by Rabbi Idi Ben Abin, who said, "He who is suspected of passing trefot cannot be rehabilitated unless he leaves for a place where he is unknown and finds an opportunity of returning a lost article of considerable value, or of condemning as trefot meat of considerable value belonging to himself."
Right. So here's what happens. A guy sins by, you know, passing off trefot as kosher. What does he do for tshuva? He lets his hair grow long. He lets his nail grow wrong, right? He's doing the public displays of tshuva. And he almost rolled Rav Nachman. And Rava said, whoa, he could just be faking, right? Because it's really easy to fake the superficial stuff. You know, to paraphrase Dale Carnegie, any idiot can, you know, put on a black robe and a black hat, and many idiots do. And here, what's the real tshuva? It's when you find yourself in that sort of place again, and you don't repeat your sin. That's tshuva. All this other stuff of superficial clapping al chait is meaningless. That's, you know, and there are plenty of things we read about this on Yom Kippur, you know, too. You know, just even doing the fast, like all of that, none of that matters. The rituals of tshuva don't matter as much as the behavior of tshuva. So sometimes people can take on a stringency, right? Like, let's say, you're trying, like, oh, I'm trying to do something better. I'm trying to fix a certain mita. You want to fix a certain mita, work on that mita. Just, like, do that thing. Like, if you think you drink too much alcohol, don't drink too much alcohol. Don't take on other stringencies in another area of your life.
But he adds on that you have to pay some penalty by returning something of considerable value that you would find, or condemning a certain...
Meaning he has to be in a position where, like a similar position where by doing the right thing, even when there's a monetary loss to himself, he still does the right thing. Right, that's how you know he really did teshuva, because that's what he did the Averon. That's how Rambam defines what Teshuva Gemara is. When you find yourself in a similar situation and you don't make the same mistake again, right? Because what advantage are by passing off trefa meat as kosher? You get to sell it, right? Sell it at a premium. All right, and in this final section here, we saw a little bit of one of them. But we'll talk about Chassid Shoten separatists, and we'll see something they have in common. And take Mishnah Sota 3:4.
Rabbi Yehoshua used to say, "A foolish pietist, a cunning rogue, a female Pharisee, and the plague of Pharisees, and the plague of Pharisees bring destruction upon the world."
Okay, so we saw one of these already. You may remember the Rasha Arum. Anyone remember who the Rasha Arum was? Ah. The Rasha Arum, we found it on, it's Gemara Sota 21b. Rav Zreka said in the name of Rav Huna, source number 17 on the sheets here. Zah mekela atzmo machmir la'acherim. It's the one who is lenient for themselves and strict on others. All right? But
You know, we've got two really phenomenal Gemaras here attached to this Gemara in Sota. Sota 21a, Hechidame Chasid Shuta. Who is this Chasid Shuta? Kigon daka tava'a itita benahara. For example, he sees a woman drowning in the river. Va'amar lav orach aral istakluye ba'atzaluye. It is improper for me to look upon her and rescue her. It's a way of saying a woman's drowning. I'm not going to go in and save her because it's mixed swimming. Right? That is considered a chatsid shoteh. That is when you are considered an idiot. This is a great case of where someone who is machmir, who is taking on a certain stringency, even in the name of religion, but does it wrong. You get it wrong. And finally, I love this Gemara here, so it's a great way to wrap it up. So to 22b. So, what is this Pharisee type? There are seven types of Pharisee. So one of them is, Machovati ve'esena. It's like, what is my duty that I will perform it? What's the problem? It's actually a good thing if someone asks, what is my duty and I'll perform it? Ella, the amar machovati tova esena. What further duty is it for me that I may import it, that I may perform it? According to the Gemara, one of the statements here about the extra prushim, one of the categories, is the person who constantly seeks to do more. Not the one who says, what do I have to do, but what is my further duty to do? And this is where we get into the problem of stringencies of chumrat. There's one thing to say if, like, you're trying to do Jewish law. And I think here it's important to, like, sum up in, you know, a lot of what we discussed here. You know, we did a whole lot of sources on an attitude towards stringencies, I don't know, taking on more. And there are a couple of different ways to, you know, there are a couple of different ways to read this. We had some general principles, such as your stringencies, whatever it is that you pick, cannot violate Jewish law. We saw a bunch of sources that seem to give a positive interpretation to stringencies, like Kol Amar Be'Reza Mishvah. Whoever does certain things in excess is to be praiseworthy, right? So there are certain things that are good. There are certain things which are clearly bad. You've got some middle grounds here of Lifnei Mishurat Hadin that allows for a certain degree of going above and beyond, and we discussed whether or not that's actually obligatory. And we saw today some things of a certain type of stringency that's defined not so much by doing a mitzvah, sort of being stricter in a certain degree of observance, because you're either unsure, but a certain degree of stringency of trying to take on more than you are otherwise obligated to do, and that seems to be, you know, a bit less encouraged. So when people do more, people want to be strict on something. You have to figure out, what exactly is it being strict? What is and I think we spoke about this the first week, it was so long ago. You know, there's a very big difference when you're actually discussing a matter of halacha. You and I can argue on halacha. I can take a stricter opinion than you. Does that mean that I'm looking for chumrot? Not necessarily. Right, I could have a reason why I'm going to be strict. There could be a reason why I'm not going to use this Eruv, even though everyone else uses. Does that mean that I'm machmir on it? I don't think I'm machmir. I mean, I'm machmir relative to someone else, but to me, I think this is what the halacha is. Right?
But you take that on for yourself, not for the rest of it.
Well, there are two separate things there. Meaning that there could also be a practical matter too. Meaning there's just because you're a rabbi doesn't mean that you're going to impose, even if you think a chumrah something is halacha that people shouldn't do, that doesn't mean that you necessarily have the power to enforce it on everyone. Technically, halakhically speaking, you're not allowed to eat in a shul. Right? And I know rabbis who have tried to stop eating in shuls, and they don't win. Does that mean that they're machmir on it? No. They're trying to keep halacha and people are ignoring them. Right? Different issue there. Being machmir could very well be saying, I know that this is technically permitted, but I feel it is more appropriate to be strict. So then, right, you know, I can't say it's more appropriate for you to be strict, and I'm not going to be strict, but, you know, I can take on certain stringencies for myself in some cases. If there's more of a halachic dispute type thing, or if there's, it seems to be more of a legitimate reason for doing so from a halachic dispute, like either it is or it isn't. Look, not all of halacha is that clear, right? Sometimes you can think, well, I'm going to be machmir because either I don't understand or because I can see this either way or because it's safer, but that's a matter of personal choice as much as a paskening thing. The other issue, though, is that it cannot be a de facto knee-jerk assumption of, I'm always going to go to the side of stringency. Meaning the fact that every now and again you could act stringently, and keep in mind, there's sometimes you're not allowed to again. Like if you're machmir like Beit Shammai we saw, that doesn't work out for you. If it's a definitive halacha, there's certain stringencies you're not allowed to take on yourself. There's a certain degree of uncertainty where taking on a stringency seems to be okay. Or there does seem to be a certain area of latitude. The problem that I see it with the stringencies are, if you approach halacha with an attitude, uniform attitude, I should say, of more is always better, stricter is always better, and you do that consistently. We saw that with following all the chumrah of Hillel and the chumrah of Shammai considers you an idiot. Right, we saw the later sources today about you're considered a prusha. If you keep saying, what more can I do, what more can I do? The main thing that you have to do is do the mitzvot. And if you don't know what the mitzvot are, or you don't know what the halacha is, you learn, and you try to figure it out. Now, as you're trying to work this stuff out, if you say, well, I'm not really sure I'm going to be strict just to be on the safe side, fine, but that's clearly not an ideal situation. The ideal is to get an answer. To give one example here, again, I apologize if I said this in an earlier class. Rav Tandler used to make a point that if anyone says that you have to be machmir, you should do something l'chumra just to be on the safe side. Right? He said, anyone who says that is not giving you a psak. He's not actually telling you what the lach is. That's actually avoidance of psak. Because if you don't really know what the situation is, and your reaction is to be machmir, that means you're not doing your job. Your job as a posek is to get the answer, and then say, here you have to, here you don't. Right? But if you're chumra, if it's like safek lachumra, just knee-jerk, that's not a psak. And I actually had a case like this regarding a case where it's questionable if someone required a get. And the first person I called was a member of the Basin of America who said she needs a get misafik. I said, okay. And I knew from what Rav Tandler said, that's not a psak. You're just avoiding the question. But, anyway, he did in fact say I should ask someone else. So I called up Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz in Chicago, one of the few people I would trust for this particular type of question. Within 5 minutes, I explained the whole issue, like why I would say one way or the other way. Then 5 minutes is, yeah, this is no problem at all. And he cited me a source. And I'm like, wow, that was a really intelligent psak. Not because he said what I wanted to, but like it was very clear, very sharp. This is the halacha. It's like, you know what? That's a psak right there. Right? Other people might disagree, but to say, well, I don't know l'chumra, so figure it out, and then don't just do it l'chumra. Or at least, you may be able to take that as a practical suggestion, right? But that's not a psak. A psak will tell you, here's what you have to do. Although there are a couple of gemaras in Gittin that do talk about a suffix get, but that's specifically built into, the halachic system right there. See the gemara in Gittin on that, don't want to get into it. But the point is, the knee-jerk reaction isn't just always be strict. On one hand, right, there's a logic to it, because it's usually going to be safer if you're going to be stricter, right? Like if you don't know if an Eruv is kosher or not, not carrying in an Eruv is safer than carrying, right? But there's also a difference between what you do yourself and telling other people what to do. And that's where a lot of people get messed up, I find, and a lot of re-education. I found it's funny. A lot of what I do in the rabbinate isn't education, but re-education. And people are fine telling someone, oh, this is the lacha, because this is what I heard. Whatever a rabbi says, people are going to repeat whether or not it makes sense. Say, oh, rabbi said, my rabbi doesn't use the air. Like, yeah, did you bother asking why? Maybe he didn't have, anyway.
What about things like eating rice on Pesach?
Yeah.
Isn't that a stringency that's been taken on by the whole community of Ashkenaz doesn't have a basis?
Funny you bring that up, because we're going to talk about that next week. We're going to get to the laws of customs in the halachic system. So we discuss that then.
Okay.
All right.
I think it's even worse with kasha, which is clearly not a grain, and the only answer I've ever heard for the chumra side is, well, our forefathers knew of kasha and they didn't eat.
Well, forget
it, so
kasha. You've got quinoa, which is even more absurd.
Right. Yeah, right.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to discuss all of that next week class on Minhag. All right, because that is an important quality in the an important point in the halachic process. And as going to show, Minhag is a subcategory in halacha. There are rules of Minhag. It's not just people do whatever you want, right? Okay, but at least now we covered a certain attitude of stringency in, at least as Chazal defined it. I mean, other people clearly disagree, but at least according to enough sources in the Gemara, it's mixed at best. You can't say that they were always opposed to Chumrot, because, again, a lot of it's going to depend on how you define Chumrah. There are some places where doing more is considered praiseworthy, and other times where it's considered not praiseworthy. What this means is, even though Chumrahs, you know, are there, or like one advantage of Chumrahs is that it prevents you from thinking, it doesn't really from a halachic standpoint. I mean, it's like zero tolerance policies means you don't have to think about nuance and use common sense. You just have a set rule and follow blindly. You could do that in theory with Chumrah, but if you do that for Chumrah, and you, as a means of automation, as a means of absolving yourself from any responsibility of understanding halacha, you are, in fact, in my opinion, not following what is proper according to Torah Shebaal Peh. And with that, we'll see you all next week. If you happen to be around, I think this Wednesday we're doing organ donation. So that'll be this Wednesday night at 8. Be well, and see you next week for the Minhag Shiur.